Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Can physicians do better in communicating with patients? What do patients need? What do they really want? This week, we're going to be discussing talking with patients, especially about serious illness and about end-of-life care. My guests are Anchorage pulmonologist Dr. John Clark and Dr. Steve Rust. Dr. Rust is Director of Palliative Care and also the Director of the Hospice and Palliative Care Fellowship, a training program at Providence Alaska Medical Center. You can reach us with your questions and your comments. In Anchorage, our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And as usual, our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. John and Steve, welcome, and thanks very much for taking the time to be with us today.
Nice to be here, Thad.
Appreciate it. So I typically like to start with some definitions, and I think it's really important that everyone understand the difference between the two big terms, palliative care and hospice care. So, Steve, you want to help us understand that?
I'll try. There's quite a few definitions that float around, but probably the best way to define hospice care is care that is given to patients and family in an interdisciplinary manner when people have terminal illness or a diagnosis or prognosis of less than 6 months. From a palliative care standpoint, it is a specialty interdisciplinary team care that helps patients and families who are facing serious illnesses and is used as a extra layer of support for those families.
And there are specific training programs now. 20 years ago, I don't think there were, and there certainly weren't when I was in training, even longer ago than that.
Yeah, currently, you know, in the United States, only over the past about 4 or 5 years, hospice and palliative medicine fellowship, accredited fellowship programs were developed. And there's probably about 70 to 80 in the country, probably going to increase to a much greater number than that. Any given year, there's about 200 or so graduates of fellowship programs.
And it begs the question, at least in my mind, why did we have to develop that subspecialty? I mean, there's no question in my mind that we are having more and more and more information. It's more and more difficult to keep up. But helping people with serious illness and end-of-life care?
So I'll start and let John maybe put his
good.
You know, he's got a perspective that's pretty healthy about this. The same conversation happened back when geriatrics was born. Mm-hmm. And as an internist, I remember thinking, what do I need a geriatrician for? That's what I do. I take care of adults. The answer to the, as far as palliative medicine, is that it really invokes an interdisciplinary team approach, which is a little different than multidisciplinary in that there's often a nurse, a social worker, a chaplain, or some spiritual person involved, as well as a more extended team. Probably the reason we need this, and John can speak to this, is there's been over time a increased technology that allows all kinds of interventions to be possible. And with that, a lot of sub-specialization that allows for different approaches and procedures and medication interventions that often the patient is kind of lost in the family or kind of lost in the process. And I think that palliative medicine was born to help address that need to try to pull some of these pieces together and make the treatment that we give people more I won't say really holistic, but more high context as it relates to that person and their family.
Okay. I think the need for palliative care also has kind of arisen out of a change in the way medicine is structured now compared to, say, 20 years ago, where 20 years ago when I started practicing, many patients had a family care physician or a primary care physician or perhaps a cardiologist or someone like myself, a pulmonologist, who would know them as an outpatient. If they had some sort of medical crisis or emergency, we would show up in the emergency room. We would see them every day during their hospitalization. We would take care of their discharge, and then we would see them back in the office after they'd gotten over that acute illness. And in people with chronic illnesses, sometimes we took care of them over many chronic illnesses over time, and so you got to know patients very well, and you knew their history. In the current era, care is much more fragmented in the sense that oftentimes very sick people are admitted to the hospital, and their providers may be people that they've never met before, intensivists, hospitalists, and folks who do an excellent job of taking care of patients but may not have a history or know the patient so well. And then we're also, to some extent, I think, victims of the success of modern medicine. So when I was in training 25 years ago, a person that came into the hospital with an acute MI had a 15 or 20% chance of not surviving that acute event. Now we rarely see people die of acute MIs. They are rescued, saved, appropriately treated with various interventions. But when that person goes home, they still have all of the things wrong with them they had before they had their MI. They still have their hypertension, high cholesterol. They're getting older. And the result is people surviving longer, developing more complex illnesses. The decision making gets harder, not easier. And we sometimes reach a point where the question isn't what we can do, the question is what we should do. And those decisions are very difficult. They're especially difficult when the patient and the provider don't have a long-standing relationship. And I think in that area, I think we'll get to this later in the program, but time is another big factor that influences everything that happens in the hospital. And many specialists and providers may simply not have the time it takes to sometimes adequately address with family members and patients these, and I think palliative care can be very helpful in providing a bridge or an adjunct or just one more layer of support to help families and patients negotiate really hard decisions.
One of the thoughts that came to my mind that you didn't mention, but I'm sure I suspect strongly that you're going to agree with, is these patients that are going home after their acute MI are situations that where they had some remarkably good health care that saved their lives. They've got to have a lot of anxiety about what's going to happen next, how long is this going to last, what's going to happen to me, maybe depressed after being out of intensive care and so forth. So there's that whole issue of the mental health aspects that we really didn't address so much in the past.
Yeah, and it's hard to fill in the gaps with the continuity. Right. That person, when they're discharged, they go back and see their primary care provider, a family practice doctor, an internist. But if you weren't along for the journey when they were critically ill in the hospital, it's hard to fully appreciate what they've been through. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's a little bit of a tendency sometimes to defer to the specialist. Well, if it happened in the hospital and it was specialist did this and specialist did that, it must have been okay. Mm-hmm. Over the course of time, I think our skill sets deteriorate a little bit. As I practice less in the intensive care unit, my confidence about some of the things that are done or are not done becomes less, and so we become deferential to each other as specialists. Mm-hmm. And again, I think it's simply a change, and it's important to recognize that change, and I think mm-hmm. it's correct that patients may have some anxiety related to not really knowing exactly what to expect, what their prognosis is, what to do if mm-hmm. something happens. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's everything's got risks and benefits. I mean, I've talked about this on the program a lot when people ask about what's the risk of medications. And I say, you know, really the question is what's the risk of not doing it versus the risk of doing it. And now we've got multiple providers may not be communicating as well as they possibly can. And patients kind of sometimes a little bit hesitant to ask the important questions.
Yeah, I think again, speaking to what John was talking about, is that there is a need for communication, and a palliative care team often helps the communication not only between patient and family, but also physicians on the care team communicate with each other, because everybody has very, very busy schedules. And if you gather these group of individuals that really are there for the patient's benefit and the family's benefit, if they actually are able to talk to each other and everyone get on the same page, it makes the care planning much, much simpler. And everybody's pretty supportive of each other. There's differences, of course, but usually once you actually communicate, get something into a language that everybody understands, the goals of care kind of fall into place.
Let me take just a second. I want to remind our listeners, as you're listening to Line One, your health connection from KSK Anchorage. My guests today are Dr. Steve Rust, he's Director of Palliative Care at Providence Alaska Medical Center, and Dr. John Clark, who's an Anchorage pulmonologist. If you've got questions or comments about what we are discussing today, which is really talking with patients as a generic problem, but specifically more about really difficult, complex diseases and also end-of-life care, I would love to have you call and give us your experiences or ask your questions. Our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And if you're new to the program, you have to spell out line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at alaskapublic.org. To help patients understand what we're talking about, what we already see or understand in our mind's eye, let's flesh this out. Let's take an example that some one of you would like to share with us about palliative care in particular kinds of issue.
Well, I guess just to reiterate kind of the adjunct and the additional benefit that patients can experience with palliative care, again, a practical aspect of kind of being ill and being in the hospital. Now, as physicians, we typically round in the morning, say at 8 o'clock. Oftentimes, when we make rounds for the 10 or 15 minutes we're in the room, family members may or may not be present during that time. We as specialists also kind of have, you know, we look at the world through the prism of our specialty, and so I think another really big benefit of palliative care is providing perspective, and maybe if you think of a specialist view as kind of looking through a microscope with the oil immersion lens, I think sometimes the palliative care is backing up and helping patients look at the big picture. And I don't think they're competing views of the situation. I think they're complementary views. They help. But kind of another comment about communicating with patients is it's really helpful to have extra sets of ears and to communicate with families. And frankly, we just sometimes miss the family or don't know mm-hmm. the family. And so I think just having more help, the palliative care folks at Providence are frequently on the wards and would be available if a right. family isn't there at 8 o'clock to perhaps come back at 2 o'clock and sometimes to get a conversation started. And I think it's kind of an iterative, ongoing process where we hopefully over the course of time, whether it's days or the time that the patient's in the hospital, can help them better understand their circumstance, what their choices are, help. Certainly another part of palliative care is they have specific skills at managing symptoms that sometimes we're not so good at, whether it's mm-hmm. pain or anxiety or bowel issues, or all of these things are real important to people's quality of life. And palliative care docs are very skilled at helping flesh out what are the symptoms that are that a particular patient needs to be addressed, and helping people like me optimally manage those.
Let me tell you a personal experience, and let's use that as how you guys would both approach this, because it's a pulmonary problem and it's a palliative care problem that really didn't get any palliative care. It was my mother dying of emphysema. When I was not there, I didn't realize things were going to happen as fast. She went into the hospital and quickly started having problems much faster than we thought, and really had very poor communications. I'm here, she's in Tennessee, my wife finally gets there, she is absolutely going crazy with, well, she thought the medications were making her have lots of hallucinations, didn't recognize who people were. So it was a very difficult time for our family. And so I'm sure that as a pulmonologist and as a palliative care hospice physician, this should ring a little true to what we're trying to talk about and put some real face on this problem.
Yeah. And there's many layers to that circumstance. You know, one layer would be having an understanding of what the goals of care are.
Or even what the disease process for some people.
And and knowing what the goals of care are might be influenced in part by how well the providers taking care of your mom knew her.
Right.
And so in the ideal circumstance, this might have been talked about ahead of time. And then with I'm always astounded at how often patients, especially with end-stage lung disease, emphysema being an example, how often we'll have a conversation about perhaps the goals of care being primarily to alleviate symptoms of breathlessness or anxiety. But when we treat those symptoms well, the breathing gets so much better. Mm-hmm. And there's some physiology behind that. People that are breathing rapidly and their lungs are getting hyperinflated and the work of breathing's going up. It's physiologically making them worse, and so simply appropriately addressing that part of it will help them get better. And I've had many, many instances where we had, if you want to call it an end-of-life discussion, but saying we're going to use these medications to help alleviate symptoms, understanding that it's possible that you may not get through this hospitalization, and you treat the symptoms and the patient gets better, and the next morning you're kind of looking at each other, having a nice little conversation, joking a little bit about the conversation the day before, and amazed at the fact that people are better. One thing we're not so good at, or at least I'm not particularly good at, is predicting the future. And so I think with those patients, oftentimes I go home that night not being certain whether I'm going to see them the next day or not.
Right.
And that's one of the unique problems with certain disease states like emphysema, lung disease, as well as some heart failure, as well as dementia, in that there's really not it's difficult to predict, you know, whether this is somebody's end days or not. Unlike cancer, which is studied a lot and based on how somebody's doing functionally, how they're getting by day to day and how much they're able to spend time out of bed, is a very strong predictor of what the 90 to 100 day prognosis is. So with your mom, the big conundrum often is that she may or may not have had advanced directives talking specifically about what her goals were, other than good symptom control that John was talking about, and to obviously try to live well as long as possible. But as a family, this is not something you could have predicted. You could worry about it a lot, but even her physicians probably couldn't predict it. And all of a sudden, there's a bug, there's something different in the air, there's influenza, there's different things, or who knows what, and there's a crisis. And this is kind of a plug for having some advanced directives in place that give family members not what I want or what I don't want, but as much as what things are valuable to me as a person, what things do I value? And would that include being on a ventilator? Would that include being hitched long-term into different things? And you may say, well, I'm not going to be able to go fishing with John if I'm on a ventilator, or if I'm getting hemodialysis, or I'm getting different interventions. It depends. And so the first step is actually trying to have some of the discussions with family so they know exactly where you stand on things. So if you can't speak for yourself, they can advocate for you for your life, of what quality of life you're looking for.
Yeah, excellent points. Is this idea of what to expect. I mean, as physicians, we know what's coming down the road. We understand what the options are going to be, but the patient has no idea about that.
I make a comment about also the kind of the complexity of decision making and the way each patient really is unique and has a unique circumstance. And so, an example I'll give that I see frequently in my practice will be a patient, for instance, with newly diagnosed metastatic lung cancer from which we can be confident they're going to die from, on average, sometime in the neighborhood of 6 or 12 months from when they're diagnosed. So when I first see that patient, initially the discussion might be oriented towards what they can expect, what treatment options might be, symptom management. But frequently the day I first see that patient, they actually look fine. I mean, they have a cough or what have you. And so when you get to end-of-life decision-making, advanced directives can be difficult for families because that patient, if they leave my office, fall down in the parking lot, and have a collapsed lung, in my view, it would be perfectly appropriate to put them on life support because we can fix a collapsed lung. We'll put a tube in the chest, we expand the lung. There's many things this patient still has to take care of, family matters, financial matters. They may still have some good quality of life for 6 or 12 months. 6 months later, if they are dying of progressive disease and they had some acute emergency, you know, I may have a different recommendation for what the intervention would be. And so one of the difficulties is we try to write down what we want with an advanced directive. But if you don't really know the patient or the patient doesn't know you, if it's an ER physician, for instance, and they say, oh, my goodness, this patient has metastatic cancer, and I'm not sure what we're doing here, everything occurs in the context. Everything has a history. The choices that people make may change as the circumstance evolves. And so it's I think advanced directives are very helpful, but it's impossible to spell out ahead of time every possible circumstance that may arise in any individual person's medical journey.
Right, and I would support that. I've had an advanced directive about a couple of years ago that of an individual who was in the intensive care unit at Providence, and it was about a 14-page advanced directive, kind of if this, then this, if this, then that, if I'm going to be on the ventilator for 14 days, that's okay. It was so detailed that it almost had not much use. What I would advocate for people in the community, people listening into all of us, is having the conversation with each other about what we find valuable. And then that allows, if you, Thad, for example, are the medical power of attorney for your mom, that the physician or team that's working with your mom can call and say, what do you think? Or calling John and say, what do you think? And you can say, this is what she values. Can we help her with this or not? And then they could help customize a care plan to what you know your mom or your loved one or the person that's entrusted you with those. You can basically tell the care team this is the context of their life.
We're kind of getting close to the halfway point, but I want to come back to this issue of patient choices and expectations, and particularly maybe use the paper that you forwarded to me, John, about a study looking at patients making differences and making choice, maybe changing their decisions based on seeing a video on cardiopulmonary resuscitation, for example. Patients don't have that perspective of what and how just understanding things better can often affect those kinds of decisions. Before we do that, let me just mention that palliative care, we're stuck here often in thinking this is for the elderly, but this is serious disease of any sort, and it can be palliative care can even involve pediatrics and very young patients as well.
That's right. Basically, palliative care programs exist throughout the country, including in pediatric units. We have some experience here in both the pediatric floor and pediatric intensive care unit, as well as the neonatal intensive care unit. Children are obviously a very special circumstance because children are near and dear to all of us, and it makes some of the more complex decision making even more complex, and the intensity of the emotions that we feel as parents and as physicians and as brothers and sisters all that much more intense. So, yes, there's a propensity for palliative care in the pediatric world as opposed to hospice care because pediatric patients, kids, tend to get because the prognosis is often difficult to see, tend to get more aggressive treatment to the very end of their lives often.
Okay. Let's take our break at this particular time. I want to remind listeners you're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA from Anchorage, Alaska. Our phone number locally is 550-8433. We do have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll rejoin my guest, Anchorage physicians, Dr. John Clark and Stephen Russ. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're talking with Anchorage pulmonologist Dr. John Clark and Stephen Rust. Dr. Stephen Rust, he's Director of Palliative Care at Providence, Alaska Medical Center. Our topic is communicating with patients. We've kind of, that's the generic issue, but we really focused on palliative care, which is talking about taking care of people with very serious illnesses. And trying to help them understand that illness, the choices they have about that care, and then also end-of-life care, which is a little bit of a separate issue, more of what we would call hospice care. You can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call locally at 550-8433. And remember, we also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. If you happen to be listening to Line 1 between 9 and 10 on Monday evening, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast, and we can't help you. So if you've got questions or comments and you want to get those things addressed, call us right now. You can always go to alaskapublic.org and listen to the program again by going to our archives. John, before we went off the air, I talked about a paper that you sent to me. And by the way, there on our website at Line 1 at alaskapublic.org, I have a link to a number of new Wall Street Journal articles, Wall Street, New York Times, and so forth, that Dr. Clark has been kind enough to share that I'll let you guys, the listeners, share if you would like. That brings up a number of issues that we're discussing at greater length. And there's also a short video of Atul Gawande talking about how he addresses or learned to address end-of-life care with patients that he deals with. So don't hesitate to look at those resources. So, John, one of the articles you sent me was, as I recall, it was basically that when people were asked about how they wanted, what were their wishes, what did they not want to have happen, and so forth, as they approached some palliative care or end-of-life care decisions, were shown a video of cardiopulmonary resuscitation, and that changed some of their points of view.
Yeah, so cardiopulmonary resuscitation is in some ways a brutal procedure that can involve doing chest compressions to try to restore circulation, sometimes placing a tube into the airway to restore breathing for a patient, sometimes applying electrical shocks to restore a heart rhythm. And it's particularly effective and life-saving in folks who have an acute, reversible crisis. The issue with people with terminal illness or cancer patients or sometimes patients who are dying of some progressive other process is that almost all of us would choose life over dying. Most of us, if you say, if something happens to you, would you like me to do everything possible to restore life? The answer to that question most often is going to be yes. But oftentimes we haven't quite shared the details of what it is we're talking about. So in this article you're referring to, when patients with cancer were asked about their preferences for life supporting treatment and specifically resuscitation, far more chose to have that intervention if they were simply given a description of the procedure. When they were shown a videotape of what a resuscitation actually looked like, many patients would say, oh no, I don't want that. It's perhaps a little bit, I don't want to say a crude saying, but I think an appropriate thing that I was taught about patients with a progressive illness is that if you can't keep them alive while they're alive, you probably aren't going to be able to keep them alive after they've died. So one of my thoughts when I'm talking to a patient about whether CPR or life interventions like that would be appropriate is trying to think through, is the process we're treating, is it a reversible process? How likely is CPR to be successful? And it's kind of a separate area of literature, but it's been written about several times that when you see CPR on TV or in the movies, it has a success rate approaching 100%. In real life, in the hospital, in patients with end-stage emphysema or with terminal cancer or with severe heart disease that hasn't responded to the various interventions up until that point, the success rate is much lower, and the likelihood of, even if it succeeds, possibly being left with some significant functional or neurologic deficits is higher. And again, patients are smart, and what they need is for us to properly frame the question and to tell them what they can expect. And then showing them with a video what it involves significantly affects their decision making.
Yeah. You agree with that?
Yeah, I think that the expectation of CPR and ACLS type, the rescue type treatments in people with advanced serious illness is the reality versus the expectation are far apart, and that's not surprising. And I think anything that helps bring some clarity to patients and families so that they can keep control of their own destiny is a good thing.
There's a couple of issues that we have not really touched upon now that I think are very important, and one is the ability of palliative care physicians to address, I'll choose my words carefully here, and you guys will tell me if I'm wrong, more appropriately pain in particularly complex illnesses. Is that true, reasonably true, not for every given case, but and how does that affect the palliative care effort?
So pain is very complex, and there's listeners as well as physicians and other practitioners that do a lot of pain management and pain treatments. One of the things unique, there's two things. One thing unique about palliative care is that it addresses not just the physiologic, the kind of like you have a lobster at the end of your finger biting you and that hurts, but tries to address some of the other pieces that change people's perception of pain. And what I mean by that is that as human beings, we're very complex, and often if you want to think about this, if when you were a kid, when somebody is about to tickle you and you think you're about to be tickled, you'll laugh probably before they even get to your ribs or wherever you're ticklish. With pain, it's very similar in that when people are having high degrees of anxiety, questions about about what's going on with them, do I have cancer, is it worse, is it spreading, that can often make intensity of pain much higher. So treating that by just giving somebody an opioid like morphine or oxycodone or Dilaudid or any of those other medications may be part of the treatment or may not be, but it may not be the primary factor that's making their pain so much worse. And that's the reason that having an interdisciplinary team, because it also can be have a spiritual component, mm-hmm. because many of us don't necessarily understand what's happening to us, but we often wonder why. Why is this happening to me? And that goes onto the realm of spirituality about who we are and why we're here and what we're supposed to be doing.
One of the other comments that we have not addressed is, and again, I was brought to this conclusion from reading some of the information to prepare for this, but that we may not appreciate, or listeners may not appreciate, that having a palliative care person involved improves quality of life. There's pretty good evidence for that, and can lead to a longer quality of life. Either one of you want to comment on that?
Talk about the Temel study.
So there is, in medicine and in ethics, you know, an important value, I think, is patient autonomy, patients maintaining some control over decision-making and being able to feel like they have some control over their lives. There was one of the kind of seminal articles in the palliative care literature was an article where they looked at patients with advanced stage lung cancer, and the trial was involving palliative care at the beginning of their treatment course versus, as frankly, in most places in the country, most often in hospitalized patients, I think palliative care is involved near the end of the hospital course. So this trial was looking at how did it affect things to involve palliative care at the beginning of the journey versus at the end of the journey. And one of the interesting findings in that study was patients that had palliative care involved at the beginning of their treatment journey experienced better overall symptom control, but they also survived longer. They had better survival, and so the authors of this study, I don't think, predicted that. And when you hear this study discussed, people actually don't have definite explanations for how that came to be. But a couple of things that people have commented on are, one, I think patients were maybe more empowered to be making decisions along the way. Another would be that perspective I described earlier about whether we look at things through the oil immersion lens or kind of take a look at the bigger picture. And I think palliative care physicians are especially helpful in helping patients look at the big picture. There is a health benefit to feeling like you're in control of your life. And I think these patients felt like maybe they had more control from the beginning. And then there may be some physiologic benefits that Dr. Rest alluded to simply from achieving optimal pain and anxiety control. At times may have helped with that. So it's kind of a seminal article in the literature, and I think one of the things that we would emphasize would be that palliative care shouldn't be thought of as something that occurs only near the end of life. I think there's a benefit from involving palliative care physicians at the beginning of complex illnesses.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Tristan, you're on line one. Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Hi, I'm a nurse, and I've had quite a bit of experience with end-of-life care in regards to my patients passing. And I think a good point that should be mentioned is oftentimes I think healthcare professionals have a hard time framing a question because of the fact that there's huge legal repercussions when you deal with emotional family members, that you're kind of, it's always in the background trying to covering over the situation. Although you want to be fair to the dying patient, they're the one that's going to be gone. And then the family is the one that's going to be left behind. So oftentimes feel like what we've done is we've more catered to a family when it comes to a dying patient than to the dying patient himself. I mean, given that they're in a debilitated state anyways, and then you have, you're dealing with the POA or so on. And so I feel like that should be commented on for sure on an honest note from a healthcare professional standpoint.
All right. I think that's a great point. In our culture, at least, cost, and I just absolutely pisses me off we have to talk about it, but that's the way it is in our society. And then we got a litigious society as well. So they're haunting in the background with everything we do. Steve, you want to make any comments on Tristan's?
So I have to, Tristan makes a really good point in that I don't know if it's as much legalistic as it is. I'd have to kind of fall back on the communication piece, mm-hmm. that often because of difficult communications, families, even within a family, may be on different pages than each other, and they may be on a different page than the patient themselves. So I do think that the reality is that the when the patient dies from whatever they're expected to die from, the people that are left are the family, and we have an obligation as just human beings, if not just physicians and care providers, to at least minister in some way to the grief that that family is going through, without necessarily torturing the patient to do it.
Tristan, you still there?
Yeah, I think that's it just feels like a fine line from a healthcare professional.
Right.
I haven't
had a lot of experience with this. I've had a couple way back when there weren't intensivists and everything else. And I think I kind of agree with what Stephen had to say. The situation I've been in is it just is worth taking the time to get everybody in the room at the same time and really discussing what's going on and what where things are going. And even when you do that, though, Tristan, you're right. Sometimes there's that haunting medical legal aspects of things or legal aspects of what's going on. So thanks for your comments.
Sure.
Where do we go? What else? Cost is an issue. We haven't talked about that specifically. I've brought it up in a fit of frustration. We've talked about the legal system. Another thing you mentioned at the beginning, John, which bothers me a lot, is the way our system does not seem to promote quality time with patients. And that causes a lot of the problems. Is that what you were meaning when you mentioned something about time at the beginning of the program?
Well, time is something I think all of us, regardless of our profession, battle all the time. Everyone I know is when you say, how are you doing? A standard answer is busy. And in medicine, there was an interesting study that I read in the last year, and it was actually done in Princeton in 1973, but it was looking at the effect of time pressure on ethical behavior. And so this study was of seminarian students, and what they did was they took seminarian students, they assigned them to give a talk on the Good Samaritan across campus, and to some of the seminarians, they delayed them so that they were going to be 5 minutes late to give their talk, and to some of the other seminarians, they let them go to where they had plenty of time to get to the place they were giving their talk. And then they hired actors on the path between where they were and where their talk was to act as the person in distress. And what they found was that in seminarian students who were late to give their talk, about 3/4 of them walked by the person in distress so that they could get to their talk on time, where the ones that had plenty of time most often stopped and rendered assistance. And so the interesting thing about that study is these are good people who are well-meaning. I think the analogy to medicine is that in terms of time, when a physician has a surgeon, for instance, has a person in the operating room waiting for surgery, they have 4 more patients to round on, and the ER calls them about someone that just came in, at that moment, it's hard for them to take the time that might be necessary to address some of the things we're talking about.
Right.
So it's not a matter of not caring. It's really a matter of conflicting obligations most often compromises our ability. Yeah. And medicine has changed. Many physicians now are rounding or seeing 20 or 30 patients in a day. And so it becomes more difficult. I think we just simply have to be aware of that. But I think conflicting obligations, conflicting time obligations, is something we all struggle with.
Steve, any comments?
Well, yeah, along the same lines, I actually had written down those same group of of studies, and the other thing is that goes along with this is that as we're part of an increasingly complex healthcare system, healthcare teams, there's good evidence that shows that the more people you have involved, the more likely you're going to be less compassionate because you think somebody else is doing it. It's kind of like, well, wasn't Dr. Clark doing that? Or why don't you talk to your surgeon, or why don't you talk to somebody else? So I do think that time pressures do play a significant role in lack of ability to demonstrate empathy and compassion and care.
Roger, you're on line one.
Hey, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
What can we do for you?
I had an incident out several years ago and ended up in Providence where my potassium level went to 7, and I was driving to from Eagle River. I ended up going down the road 3.5 miles before my car stopped.
And you didn't stop it, right?
I didn't stop it. My car stopped. And I was aware enough. I got out and walked around my car, called my son-in-law and says, I need help. Got back in my car. I don't remember the ambulance or the police. But anyway, I ended up in the emergency room for 7 hours. They said, they told my son-in-law that my heart had stopped 5 times. At the time, DNR was very blunt. Don't do anything. And since then, I've revised it to, and I've sent a copy to my wife. I got two of my boys that will stand up and can take stress. I sent them a copy to stand in for me if something happened. But I patterned it after a program that they had on American Perspectives about that girl that was in a hospital down in Florida for, many years and didn't have a DNR. And they finally, the court says pull the plugs because
right.
The husband wanted to have that done. And so I patterned it after what that program was about. And if it became end of a life where I would be a vegetative state, I didn't want anything done except to be made comfortable.
Right.
And it's about 2 paragraphs long. I've got a copy. It was Providence, one was Elmendorf, and one was the VA in my medical records. So everybody knows what's going to happen and what I want done. I've got my cremation papers all paid for. I know they know where I want my ashes done. Everything is done. And I think that most people don't realize how important that is to keep the legal thing out of it and keep everything in perspective.
Roger, let me let Steve comment on it and on your points. And if I can get you to take this answer off the air, we're going to have a couple more questions we need to get answered. But thanks for your call.
Okay, that's fine. I'm not on the phone, but go ahead and answer them.
Okay, good. All right.
So Roger made some really good points in that the most important thing that Roger did was have a conversation with his sons about what he saw is what he wanted done and what he would not find acceptable. As a human being, as a patient, at least in the United States, you have the right to kind of refuse any treatment or any specific thing for whatever reason, whether it be religious or other. I think that the circumstances that he talked about are unique in that, but the conversation was probably the most important part of what he talked about. And I would encourage everybody to use advanced directives not as a end, but as a conversation point.
And individualized is the other thing I'm hearing about. This was a unique, different situation. And I think most of us would want to try to help that guy at that time. But there are other situations where people may not really want to have more done.
And the crux of what he commented on, a potassium, a 7 is a correctable problem. And
right.
I think it gets
right.
back to that's frequently good. Kind of a basic question I have is the thing we're talking about fixable or not, and that bears on what interventions are appropriate.
Another thing I'm going to just briefly comment, and I don't want to say any more about this unless you guys interrupt me and want to keep going, but I just was listening to a podcast that was talking about this to some degree, and it really gets to this, what's the difference between brain death, what's the difference between vegetative state, and what's the difference between coma? And I think if there's anything I want people to understand is you really need to understand these issues. They are different. They have different prognosis, and a lot of things are getting misconstrued out there, leading to a lot of significant problems because we don't understand that these are different issues and have different outcomes. And as far as resuscitation and how long we're going to keep people going. Anyway, I don't want to say anything more, but brain death, vegetative state, and coma are not the same things. What I would like to ask is we haven't talked about the problems a little bit from the patient standpoint, in that patients bring their own set of thought processes sometimes, and I've really been captivated recently in how psychologists are beginning to help us understand where our brains sometimes are not the best instruments. They have problems. And one of these, or a lot of these, are called biases, and there's one called the optimism bias. And I wrote about this getting prepared for this program. The optimism bias is that many of us believe that we're at less risk of experiencing a negative event compared to others. Now, if you're honest with each other, I think all of us have a little bit of that. And this becomes important in palliative care and end-of-life care because, oh, my smoking is not going to do me in. My lung cancer is not going to do me in. And so how do you discuss this issue, which has got to be out there with a lot of patients? Denial, I'm going to be different. It's going to be a different issue for me.
So I would go back to, I'm always impressed with, on average, patients are very receptive and able to manage complex information, but what they need is issues framed properly. They need factual information. They need support. They need hope. And so a few things that I think are helpful in addressing these issues. One is, when possible, I always find it beneficial if patients come to office visits, particularly with family members. I call it a second set of ears, but oftentimes family members will ask questions that the patient, for various reasons, may either not have thought of or be embarrassed to ask or be uncomfortable asking, but gathering information. There's kind of a movement, I think, for increased transparency in medical care. And for most patients, when I see them for the first time, I offer them to have my note emailed or mailed to them so that they can have kind of, if you will, a transcript of what it is we talked about.
Sure.
And I would try to put factual information in there. I try to, when talking to cancer patients especially, share a little bit in the way of statistics, but emphasize that if, for instance, with certain stages of lung cancer, if the average survival is 9 months, anyone could look that up online, but I'll make sure the patient understands that one thing I'm certain of is they're going to live either longer or not as long as 9 months to understand the individual variation.
Right.
And so when I hear patients say, "The doctor gave me 9 months to live," I don't think doctors give people time to live.
Right.
But then I think, then patients need hope, but they need to have hope that is based on reality. And I think there's always things we can do that provide hope. You know, sometimes hope would be hope that I don't die a painful death alone. I like to play basketball. I'm not very good. But if to kind of share an example about perspectives, if you said, "John, why don't you shoot a free throw, and if you make it, I'll give you $10. And if an interviewer came up and said, "Do you think you're going to make it?" I'm going to say yes. Mm-hmm. Now, if Dr. Russ was keeping statistics on me, he would know that I'm a 60% free throw shooter. So both of those are true. I think I'm going to make it, and I shoot 60%. I think both pieces of information would be useful if you're a person betting on whether I'm going to make it or not. Say, he says he's going to make it. On average, he makes 6 out of 10. Mm-hmm. Everyone place your bets. Mm-hmm. And so I think patients benefit from knowing the facts, but still having the hope, still having the physician say, "Here's what I think we can do." Mm-hmm. And then giving them a range of expectations. Mm-hmm. I also kind of like contingency plans, because many times things don't turn out like we expected. And so I think patients benefit from hearing, sometimes things don't go like we planned, and here's some things that might occur, and if they do, here's what we may choose to do.
Yeah, that's I like your strategies, John, of when it comes to people coming for visits to see you. One is to bring somebody with them so that you have a second set of ears to say, oh, that's not what I heard him say. The other is to give a copy of the notes. That's transparency, and that will be the future of healthcare. All the notes and information will not be filtered. And the next thing to just keep in mind is that people who are sick do not have the same kind of capacity as people who are well. Because if you have somebody, let's say, lying in a hospital bed, in a hospital johnny with a draft where they don't want one, being away from their family, away from their job, away from everything, maybe having symptoms, being in a strange place, being sleep deprived, it's very difficult for when you're in that situation to make informed decisions. And we can talk about that offline.
Yeah, we're in our last 2 minutes, and this is a good time where I ask people to sum up or to say, you know, we didn't really address this particular issue. I think we ought to say something. Anything come to anybody's mind here that we need to get said?
I think, patients having conversations with family members about end-of-life issues. One thing that we're kind of a death-denying culture, but mortality remains 100% even with the very best of medical care. So we all will face these decisions at some point. I think they have become much more complex in an era where we are much more successful at treating all sorts of acute and chronic illnesses. And I think sharing what your wishes are with providers, and especially with family. And I especially like having the conversation in the office with family members and the patient, because frequently when I ask a patient about end-of-life choices, they will say things that they may never have said to their spouse or daughter in front of me, and it really helps the conversation when crises develop later for us to be able to recall, do you remember when Dad said what he would or wouldn't want in this circumstance?
Yeah, and I agree. I think that the other thing that should be emphasized for those of us who are fortunate enough to be able to care for people is to listen. And as physicians, and John will tell you that, like, the maximum pause you're going to have is 17 seconds before a doctor interrupts you and with some other thought. And often some of these conversations and discussions require incredibly long pauses, which are very uncomfortable, at least for me as a physician, I'm sure my colleagues.
One comment I suspect you both will agree with that I just have to comment, it was given by David Halsum recently in an article I was looking at. It said, medicine is not something that should be done to people, but something that should be done with people. Anyway, thanks very much. I appreciate both of you taking the time to be here.
Thanks, Thad.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. My thanks to today's guests, Dr. John Clark and Stephen Rust. If you want to continue the conversation, you can join us on KSKA on Facebook. Next week is President's Day. We won't be here. And the following Monday, Prentice Pemberton is going to return to be a guest host and on his fourth program on parenting the modern teen. And this time it'll be dealing with divorced parents, single parents, and blended families and teens. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Kristen Platt was the audio engineer today. This is Kristen's last program at Line One, and she's had 7 years here at Alaska Public Media and has made us all better, especially for Line One, and I'll miss her. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.